Genesis 18, page 12 on the Pew Bible. Verse 1, and the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed down himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves and after that you may pass on since you have come to your servant. So they said, do as you have said. And Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, three shekels of flour and knead it and make cakes. And Abraham ran into the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the young man, who prepared it quickly. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. They said to him, where is Sarah, your wife? And he said, she is in the tent. And the Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years, and the way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I am worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh. Then the men set out from there, and they took down, and they looked down toward Sodom. And Abraham went with them to set them on their way. But the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteous and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. Then the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me, and if not, I will know. So the men turned from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood still before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away that place and not spare for it the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall the judge of all the earth do what is just? And the Lord said, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole city for their sake. Abraham answered and said, behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for the lack of 5? And he said, I will not destroy the city if I find 45 there. Again, he spoke to him and said, suppose 40 are found there. He answered, for the sake of the 40, I will not do it. Then he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there. He answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. He said, behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. Then he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry. I will speak again, but this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place.
Good to see you all this morning. So good to be back. We were gone for a couple of Sundays, as Carl just mentioned in prayer, celebrating the marriage of our son Landon to our new daughter-in-law Hannah. So nice to have you both here, and nice to be back with you. That week-long trip was sort of a repeat of a wedding aside, the wedding part aside. We haven't done that before, but we would head out to Michigan every few years and spend a week relaxing on the lake and reconnecting with friends from that part of the country where we lived for about 10 years. It was a sweet week a couple weeks ago. But it had me really thinking, because we made this one with a family that has blossomed from seven of us, Andrea and me, and these five kids, to 11 now. Four boys either married or engaged to be married. And things have changed so dramatically, not just in those numbers and in the proportion of testosterone to estrogen in the house. That's quite new. But one especially sweet aspect of this trip, as I was thinking about it, was reflecting on the household dynamics that change, the normal changes that happen in how parents interact with their children. I don't know if any of you noticed this, but when kids are really little, they ask why every once in a while. Is it just our kids, or is that a thing you're acquainted with? It seems like this incessant why is happening, and you don't even have to be a parent if you've just been around kids, or if you've ever been a kid. Have any of you ever been a little kid? You know what I'm talking about, right? All these whys that happen just incessantly. Why do we have to buckle up in the car? Why do I need to go to bed? Why can't I eat the whole bag of Skittles? They're trying to basically figure out their world, right? And they're also learning relationships. Those little kid whys are often a version of, why should I listen to you as my mommy or my daddy? And if that's not the motive when they're little, those why questions really start to come back when they hit pre-adolescence or adolescence, don't they? Kid hits 12, 14, and then the why questions start to become, why should I listen to you? The prove yourself to me and I'll decide if you are someone worth listening to. And that's just a somewhat normal stage of growth, maturation, parenting. But then as we mature, and this is what we were experiencing in our household, those dynamics shift. Those questions start to take on a very different tone. There's curiosity behind it, not suspicion. There's trust, not defiance. They're still asking some of the why and what questions, but behind it, once they get older, a little wiser, the why questions are grounded in this sort of assumption, this recognition that those parents of mine sort of seem to have some of their stuff together and they might actually know what they're talking about. And so the relationships become a little different as people mature. In other words, maturing means learning to trust the person you've come to know, even before you understand how all of their ideas make perfect sense. Part of maturing means coming to trust this person, even when you might not understand all of their ideas. It's exactly what we see happening in Genesis chapter 18 in our text for today. Both Sarah and Abraham hear things from God that don't make sense to them. And both of them ask him about it, or at least are engaged with him about it. But one of them earns a gentle rebuke, and the other one is actually invited into a thoughtful dialogue. I just want to pause there for a moment and make an observation about what we see in the Bible. If you're not a Christian, it might surprise you to learn that what it means to be a Christian is not that you've got all the answers, or you think you've got all the answers. What it means to be a believer is not that you just believe everything automatically that you hear from the Bible or learn in church, or you're just more credulous than other people. It's okay in the Bible to have questions. In fact, it's pretty normal. Being a Christian doesn't mean you never have questions. It just means you've come to believe that the most important questions are answered by the God you've met in Jesus, and you've just committed yourself to him as all of your answers. That's what it means to be a Christian. And that's the difference in this story. It's all in how these people view the character of God. One of them views God with suspicion. The other one is very open to the character of God. And so one gets rebuked and the other gets engaged in dialogue. So let's take a look at it. This God comes to these people with these incredible statements on his lips And it's another lesson we learn with our father Abraham about what it means to live by faith. Genesis 18 falls into two parts, two same-day conversations between God and Abraham. Verses 1 through 15, God and Abraham are talking about Sarah, right in her presence. She's hiding behind the flap of the tent door and gets engaged in this conversation. In verses 16 to 23, God and Abraham are having a conversation about Sodom. There are several parallels in each section that tie them together, but let me just show you the key connection. All right? There's a rhetorical question. You know what those are? Questions that aren't really questions. They're a statement. There's a key rhetorical question in both of these sections in this chapter, and they summarize and challenge us with the message. The key question in the first section is verse 14. Is anything too hard for the Lord? You know what the key question is in the second half of the chapter? It's verse 25. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? You see these two ringing rhetorical questions about who God is. Mark them, because they're essentially what this passage is all about. They summarize the dialogue. They point us to the main theme that this chapter is all about. Here's the key point of this whole chapter. Let me just tell you. It means walking by faith is learning to trust who God is, even when you don't get what he says. Walking by faith means learning to trust who God is, even when you don't understand everything he says. And we're going to see that in this story, all right? Two parts to it. Conversation about Sarah, verses 1 through 15, a conversation about Sodom in the second half. Let's look at it. Abraham, you notice verse 1, isn't even named. The Lord appeared to him. He's not even named, which shows this story really closely connects to chapter 17, which precedes. And so let me just remind you, Abraham, chapter 17, verse 1 told us, is 99 years old. And he's been promised to have a son by Sarah, who's 89 years old. He's been given, in chapter 17, circumcision as the sign of God's covenant. Circumcision, as you know, is a procedure that brings the knife right to the male organ of procreation. There could not be a more clear indication than circumcision that nothing, no threat, could stop God from bringing his promises to bear. What were his promises? A child. Well, if you get a knife too close to that part of a guy's body, there might not be any kids. And so circumcision is the sign that there's no threat that could stop God's promise of the seed to redeem the world. Okay, so that happens in chapter 17. God's been promising Abraham, you'll be a father of many nations. Someday a single offspring will bring blessing. As the story opens, he's sitting there at the door of his tent. He's probably still recovering from surgery, and this happens. The Lord appears to him by the oaks of Mamre as he sat by the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth. Apparently, he's healed up pretty well. And said, "Oh, Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree while I bring a morsel of bread so that you may refresh yourselves. And after that, you may pass on since you have come to your servant." So the three travelers said, "Do as you have said." This whole encounter, verses 1 through 9, is marked by excessive, lavish hospitality. All the respect that Abraham shows. Verse 2, he runs out and bows himself. He's 99. An ancient Near Eastern, you know, old man would have had the right culturally to remain dignified, not run. And then he bows himself to the earth. Verse 3, he refers to at least one of them as Lord. He asks for favor in their sight. He refers to himself as your servant in verse 3. He offers to wash their feet, verse 4, give them rest in the shade, feed them and refresh them in his tent, verse 5. And then we'll keep looking in a moment at verses 6 and 7. He does all of this with great haste, three times. You see, he went quickly and said, quick, to the servant, and prepared the meal quickly. What's going on? Well, you might know, in the culture of the ancient Near East, hospitality was pretty close to the pinnacle of all the virtues. If some stranger came through town, it was only right, in the communal sense, to take care of them. If you look at chapter 19, Lot does many of these same things. Verse 1, he runs out to meet them and bows himself to the earth. He offers them shelter and washing. In fact, this is the way in the Bible Lot proves that he is a righteous man, because he extends hospitality to these strangers as they come. It's not at the same level of Abraham. Abraham goes way above and beyond. Look at the feast that he sets, verse 6. Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, 3 seahs of fine flour, knead it, make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to a young man who prepared it quickly. And then Abraham took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them and stood by them under the tree while they ate. In verse 5, he offered them a morsel of bread. And then he sets this meal. Do you know what a seah is? He asked for 3 seahs of fine grain. Do you know what that is? Yeah, I didn't either. So I had to look it up. It's several quarts. When you get 3 of them together, you've got 5 to 6 gallons of flour. That's 30-ish pounds of flour. That's a lot of bread. And you notice in the text, verse 6, do you see the text calls it fine flour? And I had to do a little Hebrew work, but I dug it up, and that's actually gluten-free. So he's bringing bread. Doesn't even matter. If these guys don't eat that, he's anticipated a dietary problem. He brings an extra. He brings an entire calf, some milk, and yogurt. Verse 8 says, curds. The calf was tender and good. And then he stands by as a waiter to serve them while they eat. This is something beyond normal hospitality. And if your instincts kind of hinted at that, let me explain what. Look back at chapter 17, verse 2. The Lord says to Abram, I am Lord Almighty. Verse 1, sorry. I am Lord Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. This incident shows that Abraham's actually doing that. By welcoming strangers into his home and caring for their needs, Abraham is proving his virtue. We don't tend to think of blamelessness as a collective, communal responsibility. In our Western culture, we think of blamelessness as private, personal morality. We're people of integrity, we're self-controlled, we don't get drunk, we don't sleep around. That's blamelessness in our culture because we're very individualistic. But in the ancient Near East, there were cultural obligations, communal obligations. Abraham's keeping them and proving, and in a lavish way, demonstrating that he is blameless. And in chapter 19, we'll see this is one of the ways that Abraham contrasts with the people of Sodom. Lot demonstrates hospitality to these two strangers, but the men of Sodom, they show up and try to rape them. And so Abraham here is demonstrating not just he's an average good ancient Near Eastern host, but he's a blameless man walking in the fear of the Lord. By loving these strangers, he's pleasing God and proving himself blameless. It's not the main point of this passage, but I think it's worth pointing out that Abraham's faith in God made him a good neighbor. Does your faith in God make you a good neighbor? These strangers showed up and from Abraham got a smile. Like he smiled at them. He anticipated their needs. He washed their feet. He honored these new guys on the block and anticipated their needs. The point is, true faith is actually good for the world. It makes people better citizens. It makes them better neighbors. The writer of Hebrews comments on this story in chapter 13, verse 2, and says, don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers, because in this way, some have entertained angels unawares. Talking about Abraham and these guys. Why do I point this out? It's not the main point of the passage, but why do I point it out? Because it is such a great description of how God treats people through Jesus, isn't it? Romans 15, verse 7, Paul writes, "Welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God." He says, Jesus welcomed you this way, and it makes God look good. That open-armed, no qualifications required welcome. As soon as you get close, Jesus of Nazareth jumps up and says, "Come on in. Here's water to wash up. Cool down and rest a while. I've got food ready to nourish you. I am so glad you are here." Do you know that God? That's why he wants us. I hope in visiting Parker Hills, you've been welcomed this morning. People smiled at you, saw you, asked your name, shook your hand. If you attend here regularly, you might have gotten a hug. Why? Because the gospel is a message of this kind of treatment from God himself. And if we claim to be people of the gospel, we need to inhabit a community that reflects the gospel. Open-armed welcome. Glad you're here. You don't need to audition to be part of us. There are no qualifications. All comers are welcome to come for free. It's what Abraham's doing. It's what Christianity's all about. Sins washed in the blood of Jesus. Our rest secured by his work. A meal prepared through his own sacrifice of himself, satisfying our soul. We'll have the Lord's Supper in a moment at the end of this meeting. Before the very first supper that Jesus held with his followers, he said to them, "This bread is my body given for you. This cup is the new covenant in my blood," welcoming his followers into a covenant meal. But in the Lord's Supper, we learn he's not just killing a calf and baking 30 pounds of bread, he's actually offering himself as the meal. And his blood as the wash water to cleanse us up. And the gospel gives us this amazing picture, the amazing fulfillment of this picture of a lavish covenant meal with God. It's a beautiful picture. Now, there's a hint of tension here that you might not have picked up. The narrator tells us plainly in verse 1, this is the Lord. This visitor is Yahweh himself, somehow appearing in human likeness. It's not that unusual in the Old Testament. There are a few times in the Old Testament, the Jewish part of the Bible, that God appears in human flesh. It seems weird at first that a God who is transcendent and omnipotent and omnipresent would appear in human flesh, but in Christianity, that becomes the norm. The God that we know in the second person of the Trinity takes on flesh and stays that way. So this doesn't surprise Christians. At some point, Abraham himself realizes he's engaged with his God. And that's the tension. God just appeared to Abraham in chapter 17. He just gave him all of these covenant promises. And so the question is, why has he come back? Well, verse 9 tells us. They said to Abraham, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And Abraham said, "She's in the tent." And the Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. This whole exchange, except for verse 15, this whole exchange is taking place between Yahweh, Abraham's God, and Abraham himself. But it's all for the benefit of Sarah. She's listening off to the side. We're told that, right? The conversation is about her. The first question asks, and Abraham's already received these promises. This is the tension. Why is the Lord back so soon? Here's the answer: to bring Sarah along in her faith. Apparently, either Abraham hadn't told her about the promise, a year from now, you're going to have a baby, or he told her and she was like, "Yeah, you need to lay off of whatever local beer you've been drinking because I don't think that's happening." One way or the other, Sarah hasn't believed the promise, and the Lord shows up to move her along. Everybody in the scene suddenly realizes that these guests that they've just had for lunch are no ordinary guests. They name, if these are just passersby, how do they know her name, which she was just given a few weeks ago? There's little hints now that they're dealing with something supernatural. Look at verse 11. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. We're already told that, but we haven't been told this. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. I imagine that's probably why she was in the tent hiding, because she didn't want to distract anybody in the dinner with her frantic fanning, you know? She's hiding back there. I've never been through menopause, but I've been near it. The point of putting that little detail in there is not to embarrass her. It's to demonstrate God's grace so often comes to us in ways that are impossible for our minds to fathom. How could that ever be true? That doesn't even make sense. That's where Sarah's at. That's why she's laughing, right? Her laughter highlights her shock at the impossibility of this offer. And she says, "Shall I have this pleasure? Either the pleasure of sex with her husband again or the pleasure of a child." She's just learned to set aside all hope of that, all expectation. She's just going to take life as it comes. And in fact, she describes herself and her husband in pretty bitter terms. Verse 12, "After I am worn out, after I'm worthless, and my Lord is old." Are we going to get to enjoy that again? A few years later, Sarah gets the point. When Isaac is born in chapter 21, Sarah says, "God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me." And they name the child Laughter. That's how the Lord's grace always works. He takes our failure, laughing at his promise, and turns it into a trophy. I'm going to just name this child, ha ha ha, because that's what you did when I told you the promise. That's what happens. But here's another thing that I want to point out. This is God coming to Abraham to engage with his wife. In Christianity, you meet a God who values these women. Isn't that something? He wants to talk directly to Sarah. He wants to deal directly with her. He knows her weakness in faith, and he's drawing her into relationship directly with him. Not second class. Verse 13, "The Lord said to Abram, 'Why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old?'" You notice how gentle the Lord is in his description? Sarah's like, "I'm worthless and my Lord is old." God doesn't want to say it that way. He's so kind in how he paraphrases her. "Shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old?" And then here comes the key question in the whole exchange. Verse 14, "Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son." And then verse 15, you can almost see Sarah frightened and shocked that the Lord knew that she laughed, saying, verse 15, Sarah denied it, saying, "I didn't laugh." And you wonder if she just went and put her hand over her mouth like, "Did I say that out loud? Oh." But the Lord said, "No, you did laugh." I picture him smiling in that moment. You laughed. What's the point here? Well, the key verse 14, is anything too hard for the Lord? The question that comes to us is there anything about your God that boggles your mind? Could your God produce a virgin birth? Could your God produce a man becoming flesh? Could your God produce a resurrection at the end of that man's life because he died for us? Here's the key takeaway. When God's promises seem impossible, trust his power. That's his character, right? When you don't fully get what he says, what it means to walk by faith is trust who he is. That's what he reminds Sarah of. Well, verse 16, Abraham assumes the visit is over. The purpose has been fulfilled. Confirmation has come to Sarah. Abraham has no idea there's more still to talk about, but there's a lot more. Verse 16, the men set out from there, and they look down towards Sodom, and now the conversation shifts from being about Sarah to being about Sodom. Abraham went with them to set them on their way, and the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised. At first, the Lord just starts talking about his relationship to Abraham. He reminds him of the covenant. I've made this promise to you. He invites Abraham into his counsel. That's why the Old Testament calls Abraham God's friend, because he shared a meal with God. You know, Abraham's the only person in the Bible before the coming of Jesus in the Gospels. Abraham's the only person in the Bible to share a meal with God. He's God's friend. That's why he's called that. It's no wonder he's the father of three massive world religions, isn't it? I mean, Abraham's a towering figure in the history of the world. And he's God's friend. And God invites his friend into his heavenly council and is going to share with him what he's about to do. It's common in the Old Testament for God to share with his prophets when there is a word of judgment, and that's what's coming. Verse 20, then the Lord said to Abram, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. So the men turned from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. This issue of the destruction of Sodom is a thing we'll talk about a good deal next week in chapter 19. But this is a thing that has concerned a lot of people. It's one of the passages in the Bible that some people go to say, see, homosexuality is so offensive to God, he destroyed a whole city that practiced it. Other people look at that passage and go, this is why I can't believe in the God of the Bible, that he would just wantonly wipe out an entire city. And we'll talk a good deal more about that next week. But in this passage, I just want to point out a couple of things. Look at verse 20. The Lord says, there is an outcry that has come to him against Sodom and Gomorrah. What that means is there are neighboring either villages or sojourners who come to or through the city who are oppressed. That Hebrew noun, outcry, conveys the idea of an injustice, oppression being perpetrated against weaker or helpless people. In other words, the outcry coming to God is not, these people are breaking your law by sleeping with people of the same gender. That is part of the problem. I'm not doubting that. I'm not disputing that. But what comes to God is an outcry from outlying areas, people who visit the city of Sodom and Gomorrah and are treated unjustly. And we know that that's what it means, because when these two angels visit the city, what happens to them? First opportunity these residents of Sodom get, they want to abuse them and use them. Doesn't matter what culture you come from and what your standard of morality, rape is never forgivable. It's never acceptable. And that's what these Sodomites are perpetrating or wanting to. And so what's happening here is there is an outcry coming to the Lord, and he's coming to investigate. He's actually going to get himself, his representatives, in that place to find out, do people really get mistreated here? And immediately they do. And so this passage sets up Sodom and Gomorrah as a situation where, if anything, God is vindicated by this judgment. What else could he do to judge such an evil city? He hears this accusing outcry. He investigates the matter personally. Why does he send two witnesses? Because any capital crime required at least two witnesses. If people are going to die for their sins, at least two independent witnesses need to testify that they do commit those sins. And then he involves a faithful, objective, independent third party, Abraham, and tells him his plan. And he prioritizes mercy over judgment, as we'll see, because as Abraham asks, the Lord goes, I won't destroy it if there are 50, and fewer, and fewer, and fewer. And the point is, God is willing to have so much mercy. He would spare the city if there were only 10 righteous people, we will see. See, our questions about the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah aren't our own. the questions don't originate with us. Abraham wondered about it too. That's why he presses God on his justice. Look at what Abraham says, verse 23. Abraham drew near the Lord and said, Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Abraham doesn't deny the wicked are there and that they should be swept away. His question is, are you doing the right thing here? Verse 24, suppose there are 50 righteous in the city. Would you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? Abraham is appealing to God on the basis of God's own character. He says, God, that doesn't seem like you. And so I just need more information. What if there are 50 righteous people? What if there are 50 people in Sodom who don't do that stuff? You won't wipe it away. That's our question, right? God, it doesn't seem like that's deserved. It doesn't seem like that's consistent with who you are. Do you see how Abraham's question is different from Sarah's? Sarah's question was about herself. Will I have this pleasure after I am worthless and my husband is worn out? Abraham's question is about the character of God. Sarah got rebuked. Abraham got invited into deeper conversation. Walking by faith means we learn to trust who he is, even when we don't understand what he says. That's what we're seeing. Look at the rest of the exchange, verse 26. The Lord said, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I'll spare the whole place for their sake. So Abraham answered and said, behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Would you destroy the whole city for lack of 5? And the Lord said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And again, Abraham spoke to him and said, suppose 40 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 40, I will not do it. Then he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there. And he answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. He said, behold, I've undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. One more time, Abraham said, oh, let not the Lord be angry. I will speak but this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. There are plenty of prophets in the Old Testament who pray for God's mercy. They all pray for his mercy on Israel. Except this man. This is God's agent of blessing to the world. He knows his role. Abraham well understands his calling. And so he engages God on the basis of God's own justice. Not bargaining. He doesn't have anything to offer. He's not parlaying. He's not even treating himself as an equal of God's, even though he's been invited to have a meal with this God and invited into counsel with this God. He says over, I am dust and ashes. Please, I realize I'm taking my life in my own hands. Please don't be angry. And yet he reminds God, 50 righteous people dying for all those wicked, that wouldn't be just. 45, 40, 6 times he asks a number, and God says, number's good enough for me, all the way down to 10. Abraham, instead of proposing that God decide the fate of humanity on the basis of how many wicked people there are, he says, God, how about this? How about if we decide the fate of humanity based on how many good guys are in town? How about 50, 45, 40? 30, 20, 10. 10 good guys. Can we decide the fate of that city based on the number of good guys? That's the proposal of Abraham, the man through whom all nations of the earth will be blessed. You know what he's doing, right? Totally flipping the narrative, only he doesn't take it as far as we want him to go. Right? We want him to go to 1. What if there were one? Would you destroy the city for one? And arguably, you could say, well, Lot is righteous. The New Testament calls him righteous, but he's not a good enough righteous man to spare those, is he? We just know that. We just know that God's justice will and must punish the guilty. And the trouble is, before him in his righteousness, none of us are righteous. All of us are guilty, which means Sodom goes down, and Parker goes down, and America goes down, and Kazakhstan goes down, and every country in the world goes down, because even if you change the narrative to be, I will spare it, not based on how many wicked there are, but how many good guys there aren't any until Jesus. That's the whole point of Jesus coming. And Jesus stands in that place, and God goes, yeah, I will spare the wicked for the sake of that one. Why? Because not only was he fully righteous, but he stepped into the place of the completely wicked and took God's judgment for them. It's the most shocking part of this story is the way it points us forward to the one righteous man who would become guilty in the place of all the wicked. And then because of Jesus dying on the cross, anyone who comes to God through him, counted righteous, granted mercy, spared. Jesus didn't just intercede for us with prayer like Abraham, he actually intervened for us. He didn't just offer words, he offered his own body. Which is why Christians are willing to go to this God and say, even when I don't understand what you say, I'm willing to trust who you are. Because if you would do that for us, how could we not trust you? Friends, walking by faith doesn't mean we make perfect sense out of everything God says. It means we just completely trust who this God is.